Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. It's the first of our festive episodes. If you were listening on Monday, you'll know that we were honest enough to admit that we recorded four on Sunday night. I'm just about recovered, Kieran, as I was doing the festive drinking for both of us during that marathon treat. So, all our pods over Christmas are questions, except for this one, which is a treat, Kieran. It's an interview that you did with Wycombe Wanderers majority shareholder Rob Kuhig. And it's a treat for those of you listening who don't like the sound of my voice because I'm not in the rest of this pod. So, Merry Christmas to all of you. Rob Kuhig, through his company Feliciana EFL, brought the majority stake from Wycombe in early 2020 from the Supporters Trust, and Kieran spoke to him last week.
Rob, thanks so much coming on the show. I know we're a few hours different. You're back in the States. How are things back there at present?
Well, everything is terrific. I mean, we have the usual arguments at government level. We have our state that has its own issues because we're still recovering from a terrible hurricane we had 4 months ago. But for the vast majority of us, life is good and we're getting ready for the holidays.
Terrific, terrific. So you woke up one day and you decided to buy a football club. What did your wife say?
Well, she wasn't overly excited, I think is a fair statement. And really, we were talking about the history of this the other day. I think it stemmed from a Thanksgiving lunch where my family, all 60 of us, gather, and we brag and boast and we scream and yell and we argue about politics. And somewhere along the line, my brother Kevin, who's a huge Liverpool fan, been going back and forth for 40 years watching them, and my nephew Pete started egging me on about I didn't know anything about the sport. And I said, well, it's not that hard. I'll go buy a team. I'll prove it to you guys. And they said, well, you can't buy a team. Well, they never should have said that. I immediately, this is probably 4 or 5 years ago. I wrote to Portsmouth. I wrote to Plymouth. I wrote to, I want to say Oxford and a couple of others. Obviously on the Portsmouth thing, the Mouse King beat me out. In Plymouth, a guy who is a terrific owner, came in and beat me out. And in Oxford, we went up after the Chelsea Flower Show, looked at the facility, saw the lease, and my good friend, who she works for Madison Square Garden, she looked at the lease and said, if you do this thing, I will never talk to you again because the lease was so bad. So we thought we were out and a broker, really interested guy, called me by the name of Mark Palmer and said, why don't you come see Yeovil? And again, I met with Mark and my best friend. He and I have invested in things together for 40 years. And when we got walked out of the meeting with him, my friend Dick said to me, under no circumstances am I investing in that. Do not use my name. Do not act like I'm involved in this. I said, Dick, we've done everything together for 40 years. He says, you're not hearing me, I'm out. But Missy and I went down, made the trip to Yeovil. We really liked Yeovil. You know, it's a terrific area of the country. The people down there could not have been nicer. But they were in financial trouble. So we lent them some money, which was when she first started to understand maybe this thing was sliding away from her and towards what Rob wants to do. We couldn't get that deal together and we thought we were out. We came back over. We looked and talked to various people, including your friends up in Bari. And I got to tell you, that was the weirdest conversation I've ever had in my life, just by phone. We went up and looked at Grimsby. I did. And I didn't think it was going to work for me geographically. And I'm driving back and I got a call that said, would you come and look at the Wycombe team? And I said, only if it's on the way to the airport. At which point they assured me it was. I went, and the people could not have been nicer. And they were an extremist. They were negotiating, as you know, with three Dutch super players about buying the team, but that fell through. And I was in New Orleans, and I got a call, and they said, if you're still interested, we would like to talk to you. And I said, I'll be there in the morning. And I got on the plane, and I flew over. We did the deal. I gave them, lent them some money. And then weirdly, we had to campaign to be allowed to buy the team because we needed a vote of the shareholders who were, you know, it's. I know you're a big proponent of clubs that are owned in part, at least by the fans. They are a fan. They were a fan-owned club 100%. They're now 25% shareholders. I think it's a good model for a lot of folks. They have a couple of things in the Constitution that make it very difficult. We can't move. We can't change the colors. There's some things that matter a lot to them. But we can do other things that matter to me that we can make money on. So that's the whole history of Rob Kuig and the EFL.
Terrific, terrific. So having owned the club now for a period of time, would you describe it as a high-risk investment or an expensive hobby?
That's a great question. I bought the team on February 22nd, 2020. I went over and I watched us play one game. We lost to Middleborough. We lost to Doncaster. And then I came home and they shut it down. At that point, it was not a high-risk investment. It was an easy loss. We were really confounded. We were helped, though, by tremendous support from the fans, as most clubs were. You couldn't have asked the fans to do more. We had a coach or a manager and players who really stepped up. I got into a little argument with my friend Dara McAnthony because there were a group of guys who wanted to continue to play with no fans, and I was opposed to it. My experience from hurricanes and other disasters was when you're in a hole, stop digging. And so we did that, but we got fortunate. There was a playoff. We made it into the championship. We had good insurance coverage. We were one of few clubs that had business interruption that ultimately took them a year to pay, but we got paid. We did some pretty dramatic things in terms of not laying off people. We tried to be sensitive, but to use the government programs, we became very judicious in what we did. We put off most of our purchases until we had cash flow. So I think it has been a hobby that I have truly enjoyed because I love the business of business. And you could not have asked for a more dramatic sense group of challenges than we had. So today, I don't know. It's cost us more than we had planned. It's going to cost us a little bit more, I think. But we are online to delivering, in my mind, what we set out to do, a club that's going to play in the most technologically advanced stadium in the UK that will deliver revenue from the world, that will bring to the world and frankly bring to the UK an understanding of how important English football is in the sports financial world. And so for me at age 70, that's kind of a charge, you know, that I'm getting a kick out of. Now, I'm not liking the planes. Let me go on record saying I'm done with flying back and forth for another 2 weeks.
Terrific. Terrific. I mean, you mentioned there Wickham were promoted to the championship. What in your experiences were the biggest differences? I mean, you went from owning a football club for a fortnight before crowds to a lockdown situation to promotion. And what What did you notice in terms of the challenges within the championship, both financially, but also in terms of sort of the general feel for that division? Because you're so much, you're so close to the Premier League and all of the glamour that that brings.
Well, the first thing I noticed, of course, we played two games, I want to say, the entire year in front of fans. So for the Wickham fans who have been waiting for 133 years for this opportunity, it was unrequited love. For us as a team, we realized that we would be receiving, four times as much money in league payments and additional media payments and the like. So we set out and said, what can we do that will allow us to compete and yet use this money to build the club? So it was there are those who I think criticize us for not spending more on the team. We just missed promotion, and I don't think we missed promotion. I think we were denied promotion or staying up, and we got relegated. But it wasn't because we didn't have the right players. Over the second half of the season, our record was in the top half of all teams. In the last 10 games, it was in the top six. So I can justify our players. I think the mistake we made was we didn't understand we were championship level. They said, when you go from where we were to there, there's a sightseeing tendency. Oh, my gosh, look at us playing Milford. Or what, you know, the Watford and all those guys. Oh, my gosh, how can we be playing the big boys? Well, you are a big boy. So the financial world is, though, and I know that's what you're about, is night and day different than League One or League Two. Very little difference, because I studied League Two when I was looking at Yeovil in League One. You know, there's a particle of difference, but not much. It is a quantum leap up to the championship in terms of the money that's available, the money that's expected to be spent, and that golden orb at the end. What do we do? Do we make a shot at it? Do we make a run for it? Do we put all of our chips on the table? And everybody, I don't care who they are, they think about it, because you can't not think about it. But the play, I got to tell you, the play, and Pete knows play better than me, the play in the championship, I believe, is comparable to or better than all but possibly three or four leagues in the world, yeah. And particularly the depth.
Yeah, no, I mean, as a supporter of a club that spent many years in the championship, I always loved it. The uncertainty and also that degree of forgiveness. So, because no matter how bad we were on a Saturday, there was always Tuesday night. You didn't have that full week of misery and trying to work out, because, you know, I know nothing ultimately, technically, but the manager should have done this. No, you finished the match, you got home on Saturday night, and oh, where are we going on Tuesday? It's Huddersfield, it's Wickham, it's Middlesbrough. And that was always something to look forward to. So, yeah, it's a fantastic division, a genuinely fantastic division, but also a car crash from my point of view, as somebody who likes the numbers. And also the crazy thing, yeah, last season you were relegated. We'll come onto that in more depth, but you still broke even. The previous season, the only side that made a profit was Rotherham. They got relegated as well. And it's this paradox of football is that if you run the club as a sustainable business, it comes with high risks in terms of football success. You mentioned a little bit earlier about trying to monetize the club to bring it into a wider sphere. What are your projects? What are your proposals there?
Well, one of the first things I did is we hired a global ambassador, a worldwide ambassador for us, to get us into different places, to make sure that we are exposed throughout the world. We have a Spanish following now that's, I suspect, probably in the top 10 or 11 of all clubs in England, because we are aggressively going after it. Because we market constantly to the entire world. We call it the worldwide Wickham phenomenon. And basically, and I can admit to this, part of me got excited by it originally, by the alliteration effect. But we knew we wanted to be out there. Let me give you an example of how it works, though. When we first bought the club, they were not doing even in six figures on merchandise. Last year, we doubled there, and this was in our first year of operation. We doubled what the club had been doing. This year, we have already done all of last year in the first 5 months.
Wow.
My wife, who has a big hand in it, told me that we're now selling between 15 and 18% overseas, overseas being overseas from the UK, which is huge. Yeah. Harry Gadd, who runs our overseas program, we now have a Spanish following, as I say, where we do special promotions for them. They're coming in. We have a lady who's now working with our global program who is fluent in Russian. And you say, well, and let's be honest, there's not a lot of Russian followers. But the point is, we want everybody to understand. And my bone of contention with the EFL is I don't think they have a clue how universally accepted English football is. The part of it is the existential exercise of playing in a league where you can be put out of business, in effect, if you don't play well. In America, that's a reality show that people would pay to see. So we do that. In our stadium, we have the finest Wi-Fi system now in the UK. We went in and brought in Landways, and we set it up so that all 10,000 of our fans can be watching the Liverpool game at the same time, or they can be doing, and it's all free Wi-Fi. We've gone into our system where you can order food and drink from your place. So everything is geared around understanding we are a content provider.
Brilliant.
I know Brilliant. That's anathema to a lot of our football fans.
Yeah. I think football in this country, its history is an amazing thing, but sometimes the history dictates how the clubs behave today. And I think that, you know, from what you're saying, you're embracing the modern benefits. Yeah, it would be good to be able to order from your seat. Going to some of the biggest grounds in the country, you know, my side, Brighton, we're playing at Old Trafford on Saturday. The Wi-Fi there within half a mile is impossible.
Right.
And it's not as if that number of people are only going to be there once a year. They're there, you know, once every 10 days. So you would think that people would realise this and the benefits, you know, especially if you can utilise those from a club's point of view. You know, if it's 10 minutes to go and somebody scores a goal and you put special promotion, if you buy this guy's shirt, we're going to give you a 10% discount on the way out. You know, for me, that's marketing 101, but football doesn't seem to want to embrace it.
Well, the good news is lots of Premier clubs and Championship League clubs are now visiting us with regularity to study our system. I take some pride.
Terrific. Well done. Absolutely superb.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
This season, you're playing back in League One. You're having a good season.
Yep.
Things looking good. You were relegated at the end of last season. And I think it's fair to say you weren't happy about those circumstances. Could you sort of expand upon where you feel you've been wronged and the role of Derby County and Mel Morris and the EFL and so on?
Well, let's start with the football side. We were relegated by a single point. And if I was just a complainer, I would point out that when we played Derby, We ended up tying them rather than beating them because an official who later admitted he made a mistake called offsides on our guy who scored a goal that would have been the winning goal, providing 2 points. But that's football. Nothing can be done about it. However, one of the reasons we invested in the UK is because it follows the law and it's easy to understand the rules and regulations, or I thought it was. But with Derby, they systematically set about this program, this accounting scheme that, I mean, it doesn't take a genius to look at it and say, this is, if every other team is doing it differently, you're only doing it for one reason, and that's to game the system. Nobody has ever really, to my knowledge, from Derby ever said why they did it, and that because the only reason is to game the system. So they knew they were doing it. The EFL, and I'm a defender of them in some ways because they are burdened by their own sort of network of rules and regulations, and they're made up of their constituent members, and so it's hard for them. They did what they could, but the whole thing dragged on and on and on. But my grievance with Derby is this. There was a ruling that said they had to turn in their financials. They deliberately tried to get that date postponed and postponed as much as possible because they knew the moment they did, they would be on its face, a prima facie case that they should have points deducted during that season. Knowing that if they were push back the league one, they'd have more trouble selling the club. They held off putting in their financials until it was too late. If they had put them on the day before the season started, we could have switched places, but they chose not to. And so that's my grievance. I mean, look, the Derby fans, I feel sorry for them, but at the end of the day, everybody in Derby was complicit in this scheme. Everybody knew they were overspending. If you find me a Derby fan who says he did not know they were overspending, Diogenes has found his partner.
Right. I mean, I think, yeah, the Derby issues have always looked strange. And as you're right, yeah, there is nobody in football wants that club to go out of business. But you know, my view is that Mr. Morris knew what he was doing all along. And yeah, it certainly goes against the spirit yeah, very, very sad circumstances. You mentioned that Wickham have, you know, when you came on board, it was a fan-owned club, and there are both merits and demerits to being a fan-owned club, has always been my view, because right. there's a natural ceiling to the level of investment. There's not necessarily the right mix of experiences on the board because people do it because they're fans first and wanting to be on the board. Whereas necessarily, you know, under normal circumstances for any business, you're looking for people with a particular skill set in communications, in marketing, in finance, in HR, and so on. That's not always going to be the case with a fan-led club, although many of them are doing a fantastic job. We've just had the Tracy Crouch fan-led review. We've interviewed Tracy for our podcast. She gave up a lot of her time, and we have a very high opinion of her as football fans. As a club owner, what's your take on it?
I have yet to find anything the government regulates that does better than people following the law. I could be wrong, but in the UK, you have a system of regulation against theft. Today, somebody is committing a crime and stealing something. So I don't think just turning to a regulator. And it's always, Tracy appears to me to be an excellent person. We were stuck during the lockdown with a guy who had no understanding of football, regulating who could go to our games and not, allowing people to go to theaters indoors, but not letting them go to football. So who is the regulator? Is it going to be a buddy of yours that we think is good for football, or a friend of Mel's who we're not sure is good for football? I think that there's a much better system. A very simple system, which I know people who want owners to put money into clubs and buy Messi to come play for them, wouldn't support. But it works. To me, it would be very simple. All clubs play with the same hand. If you're in League One or League Two, you get from the league your share of the media and the share of the revenue that the league has generated. And so all 24 clubs have exactly the same amount of money to spend. Same is true in League One, same is true in Championship, and the same is true in the Premiership. Very much similar to the NBA or Major League Baseball. And I know people say, well, that's not how we do it. If you don't do something similar to that, then the Mel Morrises of the world, I don't care what system you put up, are going to continue it about. As long as you say an owner can manipulate the team, not by shrewd investment, not by building a system, but by going out and finding a kid who's playing in France and paying him £7 million more than everybody else because he's going to take a shot at getting to the Premier League where he can make money, I think you're doomed. So a very simple system that allows everybody to know day one. And you say to yourself, well, that may be true for Wickham, Rob, because they don't have a big fan base. They have a relatively small thing. Is that really fair comparing them? Let's use Derby to a Derby. My attitude is different. If I make additional money other than what the club has receiving from the league, you put it into development of young players. You really want to build young players in England? Find the money. The second thing that would be beneficial, I think, to the sport is for the first time, people would actually look at the teams as reasonable investments. To go back to your first question, is it a reasonable investment? It is. People laughed at me when I first walked over there and I said, what's the multiple of EBITDA that we pay for these teams? And they looked at me like you're looking at. I mean, like, what is wrong with you guys? Nobody makes money on the teams. Fundamentally, there's nothing wrong with making money if you want something to prosper. And so I think if you put in a simple system like that, it may be that you tweak it a little bit with other revenue streams and the like. But if we knew, because here's what's getting ready to happen. Over the next 3 years, the amount of money available to English football, if we play it the right way and do it the right way, from media, from worldwide exposure and the like, is probably going to double, if not triple. So your League One could have a $3 million wage bill instead of the $1.5 million that's sort of tacitly in there now. League Two would be closer to $5 or $6 million. The Championship, and this is where it gets hard because clubs wouldn't be able to spend 180% of their revenue and then wonder why they're in trouble when the guy says, you know what? It's been fun, but not that much fun. I'm not paying anymore. They would be closer to 60 or 70 million and then graduate up. Takes care of your parachute payments, everything. It makes it simple. And the players are working for you at that point because they want the revenues to go up from the media. They want the revenues to go up from merchandise worldwide. They want it all to go. And so everybody's in it together. And you could have, and of course, when I'm lying there late at night and I've decided to be czar of football for the day, I would bring the National Conference into it too, because I think people forget how vital they really are to English football writ large. And so there's a way to take care of everybody, not by having the government do it, but by having responsible sharing of the wealth.
Absolutely. I did actually do some modeling for an organization which included exactly what you suggested. I took a look at the NFL model where gate receipts are shared 60-40, merchandise is shared as well, and showed the numbers. But I was accused of being a communist.
Nobody's ever accused me of being a communist. What you have to do, though, is you have to recognize the industry you're in. Our industry is unique. Our industry depends on the players being satisfied. Your industry is in particular because you're assaulted from the guys in France or Germany or Italy or soon to be in Japan or South Korea or whatever. But you just need to have people understand. If President Kennedy said it best, a rising tide lifts all boats. And if we're all in this boat together, a Darby situation is much less likely to happen. A Burry situation, look, there's always going to be people who steal, cheat, and you're going to create problems. But what I'm talking about is the integrity of the game and making it worldwide better. You're going to be shocked. And England will have an industry that it can be proud of, where it already is, but will be recognized throughout the world.
Absolutely. Rob, thank you so much for giving up your time. I hope you and the family have a great Christmas. You all stay safe. I met your nephew, Pete, at the Football Supporters Awards a couple of weeks ago. He was he was great company, and I think he was the person that initiated this conversation, which has been an absolute pleasure for me. So thank you for everything, and good luck for the rest of the season, and take care.
Thank you very much, and we'll keep listening.
He sounds like a fascinating man, Kieran, I have to say.
Yes, he doesn't hold back. And really? If we thought that Tracy Crouch was a communist, well, Rob, who comes across as not being left-wing necessarily, his idea of splitting the money, once you know which teams are in which division, splitting the money pretty evenly, and then it all comes down to how good you are at coaching and how good you are at football, was fascinating. And yeah, there's actually a lot of merit in it, because you could end up therefore with a club such as Manchester United or Liverpool or Chelsea getting relegated, which would be fantastic for the EFL Championship. So, you know, the EFL always saying, well, we've got not got enough money coming in. If they've got a couple of the massive clubs down in their division for a season or two, that's going to even things up there. So, it was great to talk to. Really good company. I met his nephew, Pete, at the Football Supporters Association Awards a few weeks ago. And I said, you know, do you fancy coming on? Or he says, oh, well, it's okay. I'll get the main man. And, Rob was an absolute delight.
We've talked about this right from the start of the pod, Kieran, the contradiction inherent in American sports, in that you have the country that is, you know, proud to be the most capitalist country in the world, and yet their sport is run on more or less democratic lines, isn't it? You know, redistribution of wealth. So, albeit with the proviso there's no relegation, but I'm surprised it's something that we haven't looked at in more detail in terms of ways of financing our game.
Well, it does sound great in some ways, but let's be honest, you know, you and I support Palace and Brighton, and we would be beneficiaries from that potentially. And the thing about American sport is it is geared that everybody makes money. Yeah, and as one of the things, you know, one of the reasons why this show is still going is because in English football, 80% of the clubs are losing money. So, because they've got the franchise system, because they've got the locked-in divisions and so on, it does work. Yeah, having a draft system for players, for example, would be fascinating. You've got some of the really promising 16 and 17-year-olds coming through. Lots of entertaining stuff. And, American sport is culturally and socially very different to what we've experienced in our lives.
Yeah, I know what would happen if we had a draft system here. Somebody from Palace would get overexcited and bid everything we've got on some kid from Torquay University. And that would be it. He bought the club from the supporters, essentially, didn't he, from the Supporters Trust?
Yeah.
It must have been a big decision by those supporters to sell to somebody who was a comparative stranger. He'd only been involved with the club, I think, for 7 or 8 months. Do you think the club is in safer hands? Not safer hands. Do you think the club has a better financial future, is more secure being owned by Rob Keohig than it was being owned by the fans?
Well, I think this is a really intriguing issue, because I spoke to some people at the Trust at the time of the deal and said, you know, come on, guys, what's going on? And they said, we've got bills to pay, or rather the football club has got bills to pay. The football club's not got any money. and we're a bunch of fans, so neither have we. So, you know, how do things go forward? So Rob has come in. If you listen to some of the things which he's embraced from a commercial point of view, Wickham is very much punching above its weight. So I think he is innovative. He's very enthusiastic, and it's intriguing to see what is happening. You know, they were relegated last season. They did make profits in the championship, which is unheard of. But then again, he'd done some of the really smart things, such as taking out business interruption insurance, because sometimes strange events do occur in the world, and that's the whole purpose of insurance. And he had the foresight to take that into consideration. So, fascinating guy. I thought his heart's in the right place. He wants Wickham to be competitive, and it can't do with its natural fan base. So let's go out and find a new fan base. And certainly, sort of the internationalisation of Wickham was intriguing.
Henning Vein, very funny, very wrong German comedian, now based in South London. When he first came to England, had a job in the commercial department at Wickham.
Really?
Yes, he did. It was his first job in England as he was making his way as a stand-up. He was working full-time for Wickham's commercial department, and, of course, he embraced Wickham as his English club. And the first away game, he turned up at 5 o'clock in the morning in the car park to get on the coach with 8 giant cans of lager, and was told that you weren't allowed to drink on coaches to away games. And he said that was the first time he thought that he'd made a terrible mistake moving to this country. he's still a big advocate for Wickham Wanderers, and also he's probably somebody who should get on the pod, because nobody knows more about German football. He used to be a journalist for Süddeutsche Zeitung.
He's
really interesting about the contrast between English and German football. The trouble is, if we do get him on, he would be very likely to say things that producer guy would have a heart attack at.
There'd be a lot of editing. All the more reason for having him on then.
Oh, yeah. If you would like to make a small monthly contribution to our always free to air pod, then please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. As I say, we recorded this episode last Sunday, the 19th. We don't know what's currently happening in our country or in the country where you live, but I hope wherever you are able to be with your loved ones and have a happy and peaceful Christmas. All of us here at the Price of Football wish you the very best for Christmas Day and beyond.
Absolutely. The Price of Football.
Price of Football.